from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations with scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Soundings now presents the first segment in a series of discussions about American environmental history. Seen from both historical and contemporary viewpoints, environmental issues invite questions that are equally philosophical and practical. For example, what are the roles that private citizens, as well as federal, state, and local government, should play toward the establishment of a national environmental consensus? Is such agreement possible? The panelists are Dolores Greenberg, Jonathan Howes, Martin Melosi, and William Tucker. Dolores Greenberg is Director of Energy Policies Studies at Hunter College. Jonathan Howes directs the Urban Studies Center at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Martin Melosi is a professor of history at Texas A&M University. He recently completed a fellowship at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a book about environment and energy in industrial America. William Tucker is a freelance writer. He's the author of Progress and Privilege, America in the Age of Environmentalism, published in 1982. Let me put a question to Dolores Greenberg. What kind of marks would you give America as a nation over the past 150 years? Do we have a pretty good track record?
Well, I think, Wayne, that you have to distinguish between people's perceptions of their environment and therefore what they think the policy should be in terms of, you know, in judging what such marks might be. And for most of our history, people moved along frontiers. They weren't densely populated. They thought that resources were something that should be exploited. They believed that there was a great deal of abundance. They had very little perception that some resources were non-renewable.
And there was nothing inherently bad about that.
No, not at all. Quite the reverse. It isn't abundance per se which Americans utilized, but they utilized abundance to compensate for shortages of labor, for shortages of capital. Mm-hmm. So in terms of national policy encouraged resource use generally. For example, the transfer of the public domain into private ownership, a very liberal land policy, encouraged resource use, the development of canals, many of them financed by the states, a transportation system that was subsidized in part by large land grants, the constant acquisition of territory, all encouraged a sense of national growth and exploitation of resources as a common good. And so the policies encouraged resource use, and understandably so. I think the first place that problems of the environment that we consider modern problems of air pollution and land use planning were observed in cities. I mean, even in the 1820s, there were very significant problems of water pollution and problems of health and safety. Now, in terms of how these were dealt with, they were dealt with as crisis situations often. And I think policies to solve environmental problems are really very new. There was no national consensus for environmental protection. I think that's a revolution that has come about since the 1960s and 1970s. I think with the Environmental Protection Agency of 1970, what that established was a social norm, that you're supposed to protect the environment, not only utilize the environment, and that there must be some concept of public good. Now, there are many people today who would say we don't have a coherent national, local, or state set of policies, and that their implementation and enforcement are the real concerns that we have. But there is a growing consensus that there should be such policies, and I think that's what's so critical.
I think the thing that is perhaps most troubling and worrisome to me, as I listen to this discussion and as I do perceive a national consensus emerging on environmental and some city issues, is that we still have a fundamental and I think unresolved conflict between the desire to act on the part of government to clean up the environment, to provide better cities, and the inevitable conflict that that involves with our notions about federalism, pluralism, localism, and the role of local government. And we now have a national administration which is very much in office because of its opposition to national leadership, particularly in the environmental field. So we do have, I think, a real conflict between our desire to move forward on these matters and to clean up the environment, and to find a way to do that that allows local governments to do it their own way. And I think the truth is that you can't do it that way. You really can't move forward in a systematic way, in a way which recognizes that local political boundaries are insignificant with respect to most environmental questions, and still allow those local authorities the freedom and ability that they feel that they must have to move. So this one is unresolved, and I would think that if we are really going to move forward on a national consensus, we've got to find a way to deal with it.
I think that the basic problem with that we have with environmental issues is a problem that requires us to rediscover the virtues of private enterprise, of private ownership. And I think that a great deal of the government solutions that are being talked about and have always been suggested and almost automatically referred to on these issues are in fact part of the problem. And I think there's an enormous difficulty and ambiguity that everybody recognizes in feeling that going to the government is the solution, is the way to deal with environmental issues. I think the difficulty is that we haven't really recognized who the players are in the environmental problem and where the right instincts lie for solving them. I think that the key player in the environmental crisis is an individual, a collective individual whom we've almost forgotten about completely in American history. That is the landlord. I think that the instinct for environmental protection comes from a landlord, a person who owns the resource in question. I think basically in American history, the reason why we have developed environmental problems is because we've never really had a group of landlords in this country. We have been almost by definition a country without landlords. Nobody owned the country when we got here. People who had a minimal claim on it were...
You're from New York City, and you're telling me that people don't know what landlords are?
I'm going to object strenuously at some point.
Okay, good. I'm glad to hear that. Okay. And I think, as you mentioned, New York City, I think that New York's environmental problems can be very strictly and definitively defined as a problem, again, of not allowing landlords to play their role. Now, I think that the problem is landlords, or more specifically, the lack of landlords in America and American history. The problem is that we tend to think that anybody that wants to make money automatically wants to exploit the environment, and we think of the railroads, the industries, mining, capitalists, people, you know, as pursuing the profit motive, therefore destroying the environment. What we don't recognize is that the landlord does not make money from using and exploiting resources. The landlord makes money from protecting and conserving resources. That an individual who owns a resource does not want to see it thrown onto the market as quickly as possible and used up. If it's a renewable resource, a landlord wants to make sure that it's used in a way that it can be renewed. If it's a non-renewable resource, the economic instinct of a landlord is to dole that resource out as slowly and abstemiously as possible. I'll just keep talking until somebody interrupts.
You know, let me just address that. I think that's ahistorical. And the most egregious example of that is looking at the
Wait a minute, Marty. By ahistorical, you mean
that I think his conclusions are based on things that are not historical fact.
Yeah,
it's a nice theory, but the problem with it is it doesn't work, and it doesn't work especially in the area of oil and natural gas. If you're saying that a landlord or the owner of a right,
and land is not the resource here.
The land is tied to the resource in the courts.
It's not the resource. That's the important.
It's in
problem.
The courts, and therefore, the right to exploit it came to those people that control the land.
Right.
Now, if you are a major, if you are Shell Oil, if you are now Exxon or usually or Jersey Standard, it was to your best interest not to exploit that resource. If you were a small wildcatter in Texas, it was to your advantage to exploit it, and that's exactly what happened in the United States.
Right.
With natural gas, 90% of natural gas was flared off because it was not seen as having economic value. And as a result,
this that isn't a matter of landlords, though.
Also, if we're talking about landlords, the federal government, which controls a large portion of lands in the West, mm-hmm. has an intimate connection with the environment and the exploitation of those resources. So we have to see that at some point, whether we liked it or not, the federal government was going to become involved in the process of trying to establish environmental policy. But in looking at this problem historically, we also have to understand, if we were to apply a kind of a historical evaluation here, is that society changes over time. And to look at a problem that I've dealt with rather substantially in my own work, solid waste problems, if you look at solid waste problem as an individual problem, if you lived on a farm in a decentralized society, it was easy to deal with as an individual. As cities became large and as interests began to interact, it was more difficult for the individual living in downtown Brooklyn to say, okay, I will dispose of my waste in any way I want to, because it impinged on the rights of someone else. But since the society itself changes, the environmental problems themselves change, and the way in which we deal with them change. And obviously, government solutions are not the only solutions to these problems. But they became solutions because, as individuals, many Americans did not see how to solve a uniform problem through their individual interests.
Can I address your second point first about the government ownership resource? Because I think that's probably the critical point. The oil and gas, I would like it. I think we can talk about, but that is the problem. Federal ownership of resources is the problem, and the reason it's a problem is this: it is the absolute ambiguity of all environmental problems, conservation problems, more particularly as they were defined in the progressive conservation era. And the reason is this: the way we've resolved environmental problems basically is to make the government the landlord, to allow the government to be the landlord. This was the solution that Roosevelt and Pinchot and the conservation movement actively employed. Instead of allowing land to be doled out in little parcels with the Homestead Act and everything as it has, they said everything west of the Rockies basically the government is going to hang on to. The government will be the landlord. Okay, they set up the National Forest Service, they set up Bureau of Reclamation, all the conservation agencies. Now, the great difficulty has been this. When the environmental movement, as we know it, got its big start in the mid-60s, they got a start by coming into the political arena, sword in hand, and taking on the dragon of all the old conservation agencies. The Bureau of Land Management, the Forest Service, particularly the Army Corps of Engineers, the Reclamation Bureau, all the old conservation agencies were the bad guys, and they continue to be the bad guys now. And the reason is this. It can be stated very simply in one sentence. The government does not make a very good landlord. The reason the government doesn't make a very good landlord is because the government cannot play the selfish private role of the landlord very well, because it is under constant political pressure from active interest groups to sacrifice its interest as a landlord and to make resources available at cost and below cost to the public.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations with scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to part one in a series of discussions about American environmental history. The panelists are Dolores Greenberg of Hunter College, Jonathan Howes of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Martin Melosi of Texas A&M University, and William Tucker, a freelance journalist from New York City. Here is Dolores Greenberg.
First, let me say that the American historical tradition is of individuals and citizens being private landlords. Our growth was as an agrarian nation. Until the 1870s and the 1880s, America was an agricultural nation. And what characterized it characterized it was the transfer of lands in the public domain into private ownership. And the whole question of individual property rights is a very central part of the American ethos. Now, for most of that period, the emphasis was on development and growth. And there was very little interference on the part of the federal government to restrain or restrict growth, because growth was considered to be in the public interest. Now, the central question that you face then is the rights of the individual versus the role of the federal government. Historically, the role of the federal government under the Constitution has been to both promote private enterprise and to protect the general welfare, so that those two things of promotion and protection are what we are very concerned about today. The third thing that I think that perhaps should be clarified is that the federal government is not the major landlord in the United States. Most of the lands of the federal domain were transferred. That the movement to preserve forest lands, to keep them from private exploitation, was special. In other words, this was specific and special actions to ensure the long-term growth prospects. And I think what has happened subsequently is that our commitment to continual exponential growth has changed, so that we do not necessarily see only the benefits of continuing growth. We are now coming to the position where we think that there are social costs to growth, and we have to balance the actions of private individuals against what we, in the sense that we have redefined what the public good may be.
Yeah, on this veneration of the landlord that Bill has gotten us on, just a comment on the federal government as landlord. It does seem to me that the federal government occupies a unique place. It was initially the promoter, as Dolores has pointed out, but most landlords tend to try to use up their resource within whatever time period they're working, whether it is a time period imposed by a tax code, in which the federal government, of course, becomes a major actor. That's a point we might want to pursue.
I'm not going to defend the ability of the government to distort the market through tax codes.
But you would admit that that occurs. But nonetheless, to me at least, the history of landlords has been one of exploitation rather than stewardship. And to suggest that that they are in fact stewards of resources for anything longer than the period of their own perspective, which is usually at most a lifetime, a generation, seems to me to be the wrong way to look at the kind of issues with which we're dealing here.
The reality is that it's the ubiquity of some of the environmental problems that poses a real dilemma to modern society. Take the case of copper smelters in Georgia that are producing incredibly toxic smoke that floats over to Tennessee and destroys all of their forests. It's wonderful to say that those Georgia copper smelters are simply going to stop producing copper in order to preserve the forests of Tennessee, which they're not going to do. Now, the question is, how do you resolve that problem? Now, to simply point the finger and say the government historically has been inept in dealing with this is, I think, the wrong approach to take. The approach is, what ways have been used, and have they been effective or ineffective? But the other question is, what has regulation, who has really been responsible for regulating? And we know that in many regulatory agencies, members of the industries involved participate. And therefore, we're not simply looking at the Gifford Pinchots and the Teddy Roosevelts that people like Samuel Hayes has written about in books, that these are government agents that are trying to orchestrate national policy. We're talking about regulatory bodies, often composed of members of the industries and associations of those various industries, that are placing a lot of pressure upon the legislature and other institutions within the government. I think that what we first have to do is begin with the problem, isolate what the problems are, and then try to suggest what may be the appropriate solutions.
Bill, may I call your attention to an analogy that I'm sure you're probably familiar with.
By all
There's
means.
A very famous, by now famous essay, almost classic essay, by Garrett Hardin on the tragedy of the commons. And the very central point is that by pursuing individual self-interest, whether it is the landlord who wants to conserve resources for his own private gain or private profit, may not lead to a social good. And for example, if we look at the major sources of pollution of the environment today, we're looking
Can
at
I make a, just qualify a quick point? He says by pursuing interest in a common.
That's right.
Not in a private. He says the solution to a common is private ownership.
Yeah, but nevertheless, the notion is of a somehow of a system and a common good for a system. In other words, if you look at the difference between private benefit and social benefit, and you look specifically at the question of energy today and pollution. Energy accounts for 80% of all of our air pollution today, and that comes from transportation, from electric generating plants, from furnaces, and from industry. And in looking at that, it's very beneficial sometimes for the individual who lives in Chapel Hill to drive an automobile. But it has social costs in forms of emissions, smoke emissions, carbon monoxide emissions, that the individual would not restrain if he were pursuing his own private interests. So that the role of the government then is to look beyond the private interests to determine what the public good is.
I agree entirely. Let me just come a little closer to defining what I think should be the role of government. I think government has an absolutely essential role to play. I think the Reagan administration's policy on environmental issues has been very, very unfortunate, very, very, very misbegotten. But I think there is a crucial difference, though, between the role that the government should play is this. The government should make the rules. The government should make the rules. It should not be a player in the game. Now, the government, I think, has an absolutely critical, absolutely essential role to play, a very creative role to play, and that is to make the rules in terms of defining ownership, defining property ownership, defining the kind of boundaries you're talking about. The government should not play the role of the landlord. That's my one point. But the other point is that the government should be playing this role of defining who's impinging on who when somebody lets their smoke drift over into the other state. Now, the point that you were making, Gloris, I think is correct, and Garrett Hardin's point is that commonly owned resources are the problem. And as you say, the reason we went from a conservation era to an environmental era, I think, is that we bumped up against issues and areas where we had new resources, common resources that had never been impinged upon quite so much, so it was a problem, but which suddenly became common sewers and cesspools, basically, is what it was. That, yes, the problem is the air is a common resource, as Garrett Hardin say. The water is a common resource. Rivers are a common resource. Those are the problems of the environmental era. And that it requires absolutely specific and creative government action, which is to stop to take that common and define it in terms of ownership in a way that that people can't dump their externalities on the next state.
I'd just like to ask Bill what he conceives of as the creative role of government. It's a very fascinating idea, and I wish you could specify for us what that means.
Sure. I think the creative role of government is in making up the rules of the game that everybody else is going to play. It's like making up a monopoly game and saying, this is the way, this is what happens when such and such happens. And if you actually invented a game once, and it's a very fascinating exercise because you have to foresee all the consequences. You have to say, well, can the game fall apart if things move too much this way or too much that way? You don't play the game. You simply, sort of play it through in your head. I think, take air pollution. Air pollution is an absolutely a very critical problem of our era. It's a common resource. As you say, everybody who drives a car just puts their exhaust into the atmosphere and goes daydreaming about what a beautiful world it would be if we could solve environmental problems. Nobody keeps track of the way they're using this common resource. The question is, how do we go about protecting the common resource? There are two different possible ways. You can set up a system that involves broad definitions of ownership, and once you have ownership defined, then you can use market mechanisms. And market mechanisms have the advantage of creating efficiencies. That's one alternative. That's the alternative we haven't taken. The other alternative is we can set up a system of regulation where thousands of bureaucrats in Washington sit and write down environmental impact statements and try to figure out, well, if we do this, if we ask this guy to clean up, what will that mean on employment in Wisconsin, and where will the pollution go if it goes, if the wind blows this way or that way? They spend millions of man hours trying to figure out all these things on paper. They come up with probably the wrong solutions. They impose things that create other externalities they haven't thought of. And you have a very cumbersome and non-functional system. The difficulty we're bumping up against is that we've made a lot of the easy improvements, and now we're really getting into the area where very critical questions of efficiency are involved. And I think that if we evolve now into a marketable rights type of market system, which allows much finer points of decision making, then I think we'll.
Well, could we pursue this point just a little bit? Because you're a New Yorker, and we have talked a little bit about New York. New York is at the point where dealing with its air pollution problem is really going to require drastic alteration in the way people use automobiles and the way fuel is burned for space heating, as I understand it. And the question now comes, to carry your own argument, if we can't do that by governmental regulation, what changes in the private sector would you impose or permit or encourage, which would allow those alterations or improvements in the air quality to take place?
I think the system that every economist looks at this comes up with the same system. That's, you should have a marketable rights system, which means that people buy the right to pollute. You have to admit that there's going to be some pollution. People will buy it. Then the point is this: the people who can clean up most efficiently will clean up. The people who have the most difficult time in cleaning up will buy the rights to continue to pollute. And you can have all the mechanisms you want as to setting standards, moving it up and down. The most fascinating, I think, thing is you can still have public participation, because if the public really sincerely feels that it wants cleaner air, they have one very simple option. They can buy the rights themselves.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You've been listening to the first segment in a series of conversations about American environmental history. The panelists were William Tucker, a freelance journalist from New York City, Martin Melosi of Texas A&M University, Jonathan Howes of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and Dolores Greenberg of Hunter College. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join me this week for part one in a series of conversations about American environmental history. Seen from both historical and contemporary viewpoints, environmental issues invite questions that are equally philosophical and practical. For example, what are the roles that private citizens, as well as federal, state, and local governments, should play toward the establishment of a national environmental consensus? Is such agreement possible? A panel of writers and professors from New York, North Carolina, and Texas has some answers and insights. That's American Environmental History, Part 1, this week on Soundings, from the National Humanities Center on this station.